We are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. That last track was from Sourdope. It was titled Water Temple. If you want to hear more from Sourdope, well, you can look them up on Bandcamp, but you can also go to the CJSF Radio YouTube page and listen to their live Studio 6 session, which happened recently in our SFU Burnaby campus studio up here. Studio 6 is something that we have been doing for quite a while, but we have recently been uploading the episodes we've done of Studio 6 on its own radio slot here at CJSF, Fridays at 3 p.m. So if you want to tune in for some Studio 6 on radio, make sure you tune in Fridays at 3 p.m. All right. We are going to go on to the next interview of the hour. This is another one that I did last week with ecotoxicologist and SFU professor Tanya Brown on a study that she was a senior study author for about research that has found over 200 contaminants in water and fish tissue samples collected from five different sites in the Lower Fraser River, including common blood pressure and diabetes medications, antidepressants, caffeine, and cocaine. That is a lot of things, and a lot of concerning things. And it was hard, as someone who doesn't study these things for a living, to know what to make of all of that. So we sat down for an interview with Tanya Brown to learn more about what this study represents for the Fraser River, as well as the young Fraser Chinook salmon that these contaminants are affecting. Please take a listen.
Knowing the body of research and other bodies of work that have been done elsewhere, I wouldn't say it was shocking to me. It is sort of what I would have expected to find. But what's shocking to me, I guess the shocking part, is that we are finding these chemicals in our waterways, right? And this is what we're exposing, you know, important prey, not only for our marine mammal species, but also for humans. And so what we're exposing what we're consuming, you know, we are consuming Chinook salmon as well as many other salmonid species. So just thinking about it in that context as well. Yes, we were looking at juvenile Chinook. So what you would measure, say, in a juvenile Chinook relative to an adult Chinook could look very different. But it's not just looking from it from that lens. We're looking at it, what is the quality, how are we setting up these young Chinook salmon for entering their kind of their adult, their marine rearing life stage that they go out to sea for, you know, 4 years and then return back to spawn in their natal stream. So are we even setting them up for success to even make it through their first year out at sea, right? So I'm looking at it from that lens, and then I'm looking at it from the lens of being like, wow, you know, okay, maybe I'm not overly surprised with what we detected, but it's very alarming in and of itself, right? And to just think about, you know, they're basically swimming in a cocktail of chemicals continuously while they're out migrating, and this is all being discharged and into our oceans, right? So I think thinking about it from that lens, then it's, you know, that's sort of the concerning and shocking side of things.
And like you had mentioned, it has like a ripple effect, because these salmon are also the main prey for other species as well. And that's going to have an effect just on like the larger ecosystem as a whole.
Exactly, exactly. And this is just, you know, contaminants is just one of many stressors that Chinook and other Pacific salmon populations are having to navigate and deal with, right? And so it's just thinking about it from that lens and perspective, just the cumulative risks that the cumulative threats that are imposed on them at such a young life stage is concerning.
Mm-hmm. How do things such as like antidepressants or caffeine or any of these sort of contaminants like end up in the waterways?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, there's so many. If you look, I don't know anybody who's flown into YVR into Vancouver, but you always fly in, you're looking over the Fraser River. So there's just, in the lower Fraser River, it's, you know, lots of industry, obviously heavily urbanized area, so stormwater runoff. Every time it rains, there's a volume of chemicals that are, you know, with that rainwater is also carrying a number of contaminants, whether it's hydrocarbons from our streets, tire associated chemicals, pesticides from agricultural runoff. All of this would be coming into the Fraser River. And then also into our lower flowing tributaries that also flow into the Fraser River, where they would be expected to be at even higher concentrations. And these are also really important salmon rearing areas. So I think, you know, it's industry. So those are our point sources. Non-point sources, we're more thinking about the agricultural runoff that I mentioned. Wastewater treatment effluent, number of wastewater treatment plants all along the lower Fraser. So there's just a number of sources coming in.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know this was, you know, a bit past the scope of the study, but looking at the data that was collected, one of the main thoughts that came into my head is what can even be done about this? Mm-hmm. What should be done about this? And I'm wondering if you have any perspective on that to share.
Yeah, I think my hope, you know, going into this study was to bring about awareness, you know, for the general public, but for the scientific community of what we painted, you know, detecting over 200 chemicals. There are far more chemicals in that system than what we detected. That's just, we went out and we tried to measure as many possible chemicals as possible if you look at, in Canada, we have over 3,200 high volume use chemicals that are used in production in this country. And so we just don't have the capacity or the analytical capacity to measure those. So this, you know, it's, this 200 is there's much more that these salmon are being exposed to. And so when I'm thinking about that, one thing is just one to draw awareness, you know, in terms of what are we detecting out there, but the context of what we put it in this research that we did was, it's one thing to detect a chemical or pollutant, but it's another to relate that to risk. So we were looking at it in terms of the toxicity. So every chemical has a different toxicity. And so what I mean by that is a chemical toxic at different concentrations? And so that's where the kind of the ranking or the prioritization came in of how we said, well, these ones are the kind of the priority ones. So it's really what we thought, these ones are what we're putting forward as these 16 chemicals, as priority chemicals that we feel strongly are likely posing a risk to Chinook salmon, as well as other aquatic biota in the Fraser River. And then we had other ones, 23 other contaminants, where we were like, these are watch list compounds that we want to flag as for future monitoring and that should be assessed. So you're kind of coming back to your question of, well, what can we do? You know, I think one, the awareness, two, for authorities like our chemical regulators, just to be mindful of how can we now turn off the tap of getting these chemicals, you know, finding ways and being creative and innovative of how can we, you know, look for improving even wastewater discharge. You know, are there other innovative ways that can, or reducing stormwater runoff and cleaning up that stormwater runoff before it's entering our salmon bearing streams, as well as agricultural runoff. So I think there's a lot of, we have the capacity to improve a lot in that area.
It was interesting, like, hearing you speak about the different, like, priorities given to different contaminants or chemicals, depending on, like, their severity. I guess, are there some where that's sort of not even known yet, how that could be affecting salmon?
Yeah, and I think there's, you know, what we don't know is probably much larger than what we do know. So that's another scary aspect about the number of chemicals that are actually in our environment, right? So when we set on this large endeavor to try to find all the kind of, we call them thresholds, essentially. So studies that have gone out and looked at, does this chemical cause an effect in, say, fish or other aquatic biota? And then you're comparing that to the actual concentrations that you're measuring in either the water or the tissue. What we, you know, there was a rather short list of chemicals that we could actually do that for, if you're thinking in the context of the broader list that we were even able to measure. And so that's why we used a number of different approaches. So it's a great question that you have. And yeah, the short answer is that, you know, we need to catch up on the science in terms of identifying the risk that a lot of these compounds that pose to aquatic biota and humans as well. You always have to put it in the context. So everything we eat has contaminants, right? Because, and I think, but there's a lot of other aspects about the food, the quality of our foods kind of outweigh the exposure to those compounds and to those chemicals. So you have to think about it in kind of a few different lenses, if you will. And so, you know, even when we're thinking about, you know, important food items like salmon, just the nutritional value and quality kind of exceeds a lot of the exposure that, say, that humans would be exposed to. And what we were measuring, we were looking at juvenile Chinook. So most people are obviously eating adult Chinook. So very different chemicals that we would, you know, the levels would look very different in an adult Chinook versus a juvenile Chinook. And so, and even, you know, when I'm looking at it from a toxicologist perspective, you know, my concern over, my concern will be coming, albeit higher concern, say, for pharmaceuticals or current use pesticides and the impacts they might have on juvenile Chinook over, say, in the adult Chinook. We're more concerned about more of those bioaccumulative, and what I mean are contaminants that accumulate in the fat tissue or muscle tissue of an organism over time as they age, but also when you get into a marine food web, as you feed higher in a trophic level, say for like example, our killer whales, they feed very high on, they feed high in the trophic level. And so those marine mammals are exposed to much higher concentrations of these types of contaminants that tend to accumulate more in fat tissue as well as muscle tissue. So yeah, just thinking about it in that context as well. But I think just coming back to you, you always have to, there's the cost and the benefits, right? And so, yeah, just putting that in that perspective. And we can look at, you know, there has been work from past work that my group, as well as others, just looking at you at how contaminated different salmonid species are, or even different populations of Chinook salmon. So there, you can look at it from that perspective as well.
So yeah, it's very multifaceted, a lot of nuance
in
measuring the contaminants and toxicity of certain salmonids, as you said.
Salmon species.
Yes. That, I believe, was all the time that I had for this interview. But if there was anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to mention or speak about, or you think is an important takeaway for this study for people to know about, what would that be?
I think just that, you know, the Fraser is not, you know, is not, it's unique in that, you know, it's one of Canada's, it was once our, the largest salmon bearing river, but it's not unique in the sense of, and it comes back to kind of your first question, was I surprised to find these 200 contaminants that we detected, or were we surprised? And I think, you know, anywhere we look, whether we're looking in the Great Lakes or even south of the border in Washington State, it's not unique in that we would expect to find a lot of these compounds and even more compounds if we had the ability to detect them and measure them in our freshwater systems, right? And in our ocean. And so I think being mindful of what we're exposing, of what is in our environment, right? And then putting the pressure on regulators and in terms of how can we turn off the tap on these contaminants.
Once again, that was our conversation with Tanya Brown, ecotoxicologist and SFU professor, as well as senior study author for a recent research study that found over 200 contaminants within the Lower Fraser River affecting juvenile Chinook salmon populations. Thank you to Tanya Brown for that interview. Before we get into the next talk piece of the hour, let's play a couple of PSAs for all of you this morning.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Between running the AC in summer and the furnace in winter, heating and cooling costs can add up quickly. And as electricity and gas rates rise, many Americans are spending thousands of dollars a year on energy. But Gordon Vumard, a weatherization professional in Illinois, says you can take small, inexpensive steps to cut your heating and cooling costs.
There are little things you can do in your home to improve your own personal energy efficiency.
For example, shut heating and cooling vents in rooms you do not use. In winter, you can install temporary plastic window insulation films to keep out the cold, and open curtains or blinds on south-facing windows to let in sun and heat. But in the summer, close blinds to keep heat out. Vumard also recommends switching to LED light bulbs. These use less energy, which will reduce your power bill and generate less heat. And remember to run the exhaust fan while showering.
That's a lot of hot air that's in your shower. In the middle of summer, your AC will have to fight that as well.
Vumard says an efficiency expert can help you decide if larger projects, like adding insulation or upgrading your heating system, are worth it. But even small, inexpensive changes can help you save energy and money. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is Bird Note. This young northern flicker is calling from the ground. Sound like trouble? Well, just because a young bird is on the ground doesn't necessarily mean it's sick or injured. At this time of year, juvenile northern flickers are leaving their nests. They fledge when they're 3 or 4 weeks old and almost as big as their parents, 11 or 12 inches long. Although you may picture a woodpecker high on a tree trunk, northern flickers, young and old, actually forage mostly on the ground. So this young flicker, just out of its nest, is poking around in the dirt and leaf litter, looking for ants and other insects. It makes test flights and, day by day, reaches higher and higher into the trees. But you'll still see it regularly, beak down in your lawn, probing for food. The best thing you can do for the young flicker, and other fledgling birds too, is to give the bird some space. And especially, keep your cats indoors. Next spring, this bird will probably be drumming on your roof, advertising for a mate. To learn what to do if you do find a sick or injured bird, visit our website, birdnote.org. We'll help you find your local wildlife rehabilitator. I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org. to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
Coming up next on Speak Up, we have a piece coming from CHLY on Vancouver Island. This is a report from their Comox Valley journalist, Jeannie Lin, on the Comox Valley Water Services urging residents to be aware of water consumption habits during Watershed Awareness Week. Obviously something that is tailored to the Comox Valley, but awareness and education around the usage of water is something that I think is important for all British Columbians. So I hope you take a listen.
This is a CHLY news update. The Comox Valley Regional District is making sure residents are well informed about where their water comes from. Watershed Awareness Week runs from May 26 to the 30th. The initiative, now in its third year, aims to educate the public about the importance of protecting the water supply. The Comox Lake Watershed provides clean drinking water for more than 50,000 residents in the region. Mike Hirschmiller is the manager of water services in the regional district. He talks about its importance.
The watershed is the source of our water supply. So ultimately, the better you can protect it, the better you can maintain its good functioning condition, the better your water quality is going to get when it comes into your treatment facility.
According to Watersheds Canada, a watershed is an area of land which rain and snow falls into, which then all drains to the same basin. The Comox Lake watershed is a connected network of rivers, creeks, and wetlands that feed into Comox Lake, the main supplier of water for Comox Valley residents. The regional district also manages the Black Creek Oyster Bay, Graham Lake, Royston, and Union Bay water systems. Throughout this week, the regional district is inviting the public to take guided tours, watch presentations, and participate in family-friendly activities related to water conservation efforts. Christina Willer-Steppen is a creator of the Connected by Water project, which has a goal of building community engagement to support water conservation efforts. She talks about how the current threats to the Comox Lake watershed can be mitigated.
There are certain threats that have been identified in our watershed right now. Some really key ones are the drought and fire protection. So just to spin that into public education, talk about what people can do about that. And that means making sure that you're not having fires outside of when you're allowed to, making sure that you never have a campfire where you're not allowed to. In fact, in the Comox Lake watershed area, the only sanctioned places to have campfires when there's not a ban on are the two campsites. Making sure that motorized vehicles aren't trucking through the forest and sparking fires. So fire protection is really important this year with the combination of drought and us knowing that's a threat to our watershed. And then when we go on water restrictions, listening to the rules and following them and not using more than your share, just again keeping in mind that we have a role to play in protecting the whole system.
Willer-Steppen explains the impacts of climate change on the Comox Lake watershed.
I think in terms of climate impacts on our entire watershed, definitely noticing less snowpack in the winter. Snowpack is technically a lot of our water storage in the Comox Valley. So when we don't have a lot of snowpack, then we don't have as much water stored. People maybe don't think of snow in that way. Making sure that forests remain intact, again, back to the fire thing, but also we're noticing climate change effects in forests and ecosystems and creek levels in general. And so just people having an awareness of that in general so that they take care when they're on the land.
In February, the Ministry of Water, Land and Resource Stewardship found that Vancouver Island saw lower than normal snowpack in the winter of 2026, at just 39% of normal. Kaylin Prochesky is the executive director of Project Watershed, which focuses on restoring sensitive habitats. She explains why the low snowpack matters for the water supply.
There's a general transition in a lot of areas away from a snowpack regime to a more rain-based regime. So in the wintertime and into the spring, instead of there being a lot of snow that's deposited into the mountains, you'll be seeing just a shift towards a more rain-based regime. So that means there is less of that maintained snowpack into the spring and summer that provides those base flows. So it just means there's just a shift in the regime, which changes where and when water is available.
Prochesky says it's important to be mindful of our consumption habits.
There are places that, are less affected by drought and do have substantial water resources. You know, the Great Lakes are very, very big. but in other areas where we're really reliant on any individual basin for our drinking water, we're definitely a little bit more at risk. You know, for the most part, our water comes from Comox Lake. And so the health of Comox Lake is really critical for our clean water and our drinking water supply. So I think it's really important that people understand generally where our water comes from and the actions and things that are happening in the landscape around the lake and the effects that those have on our clean water.
Hirschmiller says the simplest method to conserve water is to use only what you need.
We use about, in the wintertime, the Comox Valley uses about 20 million liters of water a day, of drinking water. In the summertime, that can balloon to 50 million liters. So that's an extra 30 million liters above what we'd call your base usage. So that number is other stuff. It's outdoor. It's generally sprinkling lawns. It's, you know, washing driveways, washing houses. A lot of it is required and some can be, you know, considered important use, but a lot of it is not required use. Required use is kind of what we look at, that 20 million liters in the winter. So in the summertime when that goes up, we have to make sure our pipes are bigger, our pumps are bigger, our reservoirs are bigger, we're using more chemical to disinfect. So there's a whole bunch of other kind of reasons of why we want to reduce the water, but really in the summertime is when the environment needs it more than anything as well. So the more we're taking out of the environment, the less is in the river for the fishes and for just the environmental needs of the ecosystems.
Hirsch Miller says one goal of Watershed Awareness Week is for people to understand how the water system works.
People have got to understand that, you know, that we live in a rainforest, we have lots of rain, but we don't capture all that. That's the amount of water to store like in the lake is finite. When people understand the process, then they can, it's easier for them to help. It's easier for them to adhere to guidelines and kind of follow those things that are put in place to try to protect the resource.
Comox Valley Regional District announced that stage 2 of water restrictions will be in effect on June 4th. The new restrictions will limit lawn and garden sprinkling to only 3 hours a day for 2 days a week. For CHLY News, I'm Jeannie Lin.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you to Jeannie Lin and CHLY for that report. And we have reached the very end of the hour, but we have a talk hour every 10 a.m. for every weekday here at CJSF. And tomorrow, Wednesday, 10 a.m., we have Intravenous with our public affairs and talk coordinator, Nicole Hines, who's here in studio with me right now to tell you all about what you can expect tomorrow at 10 a.m.
Absolutely. I am happy to be here. So I have a couple interviews that I will be sharing tomorrow. I am going to be chatting with Wiley Wei Jun Ho, who is a featured author at the Litter Asian Festival. We'll also be talking about her book, The Astronaut Children of Dunbar Street. It is a memoir, and it is so interesting. So I can't wait to share that conversation. And then I'm going to have an interview that I'm sharing with Fake Knot artistic director, choreographer, and performer Ralph Escamillan, who is going to chat about the world premiere of My House, and it is a performance celebrating ballroom culture.
That's a lot of titles.
Listen. But great conversations ahead, so I'm really excited to share that. And then, of course, there's going to be other things that I'll talk about too.
Mm-hmm. Local music, absolutely. Local talk. You're going to be hosting. It's going to be a great time. And yeah, make sure you tune in tomorrow, 10 a.m. for Intravenous with Nicole. In about 1 minute, we have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. But also today on Tuesday, we have a lot of other amazing programs that you should make sure you stay tuned for. At noon after Democracy Now! We have Raccoon City with Katie Wilkie. Typically Tuesdays at 1 p.m. And if you tune in later tonight, you'll hear Slumber Party at 6 p.m. and then Bitcoover with music coordinator Connor Ashton at 8 p.m. So yeah, once again, I want to thank you all so much for tuning in. This hour always means the world to all of us here at the station. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else in the world except right here with all of you. And until next week, peace.
You are tuned in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.